my understanding that we've, besides the other high schools that were here for the first argument, we also now have students from Newell High School, and welcome. There are publications available in the lobby explaining about this term of court and also how our court system works if you'd like to help yourselves, if you already haven't had the opportunity to do so. The next case for oral argument is the State of South Dakota versus Troy Tigan. For the appellant, Mr. Tigan, is Mr. Kevin Lewis, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Frank Gagan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Lewis, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. Mr. Troy Tigan was convicted after an 8-day jury trial of kidnapping of a Troy Klug. During the course of that trial, the state was able to use many different forms of evidence that were prejudicial to Mr. Tigan. First thing I'd like to talk about is, can you have a conspiracy with someone who's incompetent?
Could you just, for the sake of the audience, just maybe just give a one-minute synopsis of the facts of the case so people understand what we're talking about?
Your Honor, yes. This case involved basically allegations surrounding the meth drug trade in western South Dakota, the dealing of drugs, the allegations that money was owed by someone, and they, Mr. Tigan and Ms. Kendall, and initially Mr. Cook, were accused of kidnapping Troy Klug, torturing him, and he's not been heard of since.
Thank you.
Mr. Tigan was convicted at trial, received 100 years in the South Dakota State Penitentiary. Ms. Kendall, after a lengthy stay at Human Services Center, was restored to competency and pled to a pursuant to a plea agreement to a hard cap of 20 years. The hard cap meaning the judge signed off on it, and received 20 years in South Dakota State Penitentiary. Mr. Cook went from facing mandatory life to pleading guilty to a Class 1 misdemeanor of misprison of felony, meaning that he knew a crime was going on and he didn't admit to it or tell law enforcement about it, and he got 1 year in the Pennington County Jail.
And that was the where he actually saw Mr. Klug in a trunk.
That was his statement.
Tied up and still alive and didn't notify the police.
That is correct. That's part of the his version of what happened, yes.
Now, you referred to, in your statement of facts, you referred to allegations in several occasions. But we as a Supreme Court, as an appellate court, who are reviewing the record from the circuit court, we can't take those just as allegations. We must take them in the light most favorable to the verdict or to the conviction.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. When
I was writing it, I may have written allegations thinking.
Right. But to us, they're not allegations anymore. They're beyond that.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the record, and that's what the jury found to be the facts. Back to, can you have a conspiracy with someone who's incompetent? Cynthia Kendall was declared incompetent by the circuit court, by Judge Tice. He was sitting for Judge Kern because Judge Kern was unavailable. I can't remember why. I was not trial counsel in this case. I'm unable to answer a lot of questions about what happened at trial or why was this done this way because I wasn't there. A conspiracy is an agreement between two or more people to commit an illegal act. It is a void contract. But still, you have to have an agreement. And in order to have an agreement, you have to have a meeting of the minds. And if a person is incompetent, how can they have a meeting of the mind with another person? In a civil conspiracy, you need two or more persons to make an agreement. And same thing with a criminal conspiracy. Ms. Kendall had been adjudged to be incompetent and not to stand trial, meaning that she did not understand the nature and the offense against her and able to assist her attorney.
But was she found incompetent or insane at the time that this kidnapping occurred?
Well, Your Honor, Insanity was not addressed.
Right.
And insanity is really not part of incompetency in this particular case. Because you can be incompetent but still be sane.
Right, I understand. Well, okay, let's just limit it then to competency. Was there any finding made by the trial judge, Judge Tice, that she was not competent at the time of the kidnapping?
Your Honor, according to the findings of fact 47 from Judge Tice, Ms. Kendall's psychiatric illness have continued since 1999 and were ongoing before Ms. Kendall's current charges. The significant finding of fact 53, significant brain injury in 1999, along with psychiatric illness, substance abuse, impaired her cognitive abilities. Finding 54 was Ms. Kendall's abilities to concentrate, plan ahead, learn from past events, and link past events to future events were significantly compromised. In finding 46, in August 2000, and I think it said 6, but that would be this last year, which should be 2004, she was declared to be suffering from bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder by the Social Security Administration as part of a claim for SSI benefits. So there's plenty history and evidence here that she was incompetency did not just become something that happened because she was charged with a crime. The state tried to argue that she was malingering, but Dr. Koval and Dr. Manlove both performed extensive testing on that to question whether or not she was malingering, and the state psychologist really didn't do much on that and was found to not be credible in his opinion. And Dr. Manlove started his incompetency in the fall of 2004, shortly after she was charged with this crime. So there's plenty of evidence that from Judge Tice's findings that she was incompetent way before the charges and at the time of this alleged conspiracy. Conspiracy.
Judge Tice didn't find precisely that. Wouldn't you have to infer that?
Yes.
Well, isn't that what the jury did?
Well, no, because the issue of competency was not before the jury. The issue of competency was before the trial judge on the decision to allow in co-conspirator hearsay statements that were allowed to come in, that statements that she had been making to these other people.
And what's your position on the state's request for us to take judicial notice of the fact that she was subsequently found to be competent?
Well, Your Honor, my position is the fact is she was subsequently found to be competent 2 years after, a year and a half after this went to trial, and a little over 2 years since the charges. I mean, it shows that she was incompetent for a continuing time afterwards. I mean, when she was declared competent, I was in the finishing parts of this brief, and it's like, okay, I'd already asked the court for a lot of time to write this and get extra pages because of the extensive nature of this case, and I just went forward without that. Because it, quite frankly, was not relevant as to what was going on in 2004.
Well, do you have a case that says that when a person is, let's assume that she is incompetent at the time of the kidnapping, are there cases that say that you can't be a conspirator if you're incompetent, as opposed to insane?
Yeah, Your Honor, was unable to find any specific cases on that point. I kind of look more towards trying to look towards contract law, because what is a conspiracy? It's an agreement to commit a crime. And it's an illegal contract. We go back to first-year law school contracts. That's a void contract. It's not enforceable. It's anything like that. But still, you have to be competent. I mean, it's a very simple maximum in our law that you have to be competent to enter into an agreement. So, I found the Setliff case, which was a civil conspiracy, which talked about, may happen to have some type of agreement to commit a tort, which is a civil wrong. But that's where I am on that, is that I think that you have to be competent to enter into an agreement, regardless. And we protect incompetency from entering into agreements. The trial judge erred, the trial judge being Judge Kern, because she didn't sit on the competency hearing part, the first one with Ms. Kendall, is she erred in allowing, finding that there she could have a conspiracy, Ms. Kendall could have a conspiracy with Mr. Teagan, and again, she cited in her findings of fact, number 8, the standard of insanity. And insanity is not the standard, it's competency. While a person may be incompetent and insane, a person can be incompetent but still sane. So the state alleges the same thing, and I think that's a misstatement of the position, is that the position is you have to be competent, not insane. And
you know, it kind of, to me, it kind of goes against, your argument kind of goes against common sense. If I went out and found, you know, who's somebody who, say, is just a blooming idiot, say they have an IQ of 20,
mm-hmm.
and, but the person is big and powerful and kind of like the young man in Of Mice and Men or something
sure.
like this, and he doesn't know his own strength, and he doesn't know a lot of other things. But if I conspire with him to go over and beat somebody up, I mean, what common sense tells you that that can't be used as evidence against me?
Well, common sense is that first off, I guess we'd be talking about the statements that this young man from Mice and Men was making about you, saying, I don't. You know, going and talking to people saying, whoa, Justice Sabers told me to beat up, you know, so-and-so. And that's where the co-conspirator comes in. And he may not necessarily understand what he's saying or what he's doing or that there was an agreement to do something. I think it's perfect common sense in that how can you have an agreement with someone who's incompetent?
But doesn't person who is competent, if there is a conspiracy, receive the same benefit from that agreement, whether the party is making an agreement with is competent or not. He's getting the same help, cooperation, or whatever, whether you've got a genius or an incompetent.
Correct. They're receiving a benefit, I guess, of the other person acting in accord.
Benefit of the bargain.
Oh, I don't know benefit of the bargain, but you know,
you don't want to go benefit, that far.
No, I don't want to go in that far. Especially in criminal court, you know, benefit of the bargain, something else. So,
how are you able to challenge those statements that came in on competency of the person who made them?
Well, you're able to challenge them because the court has, in order to allow for co-conspirator hearsay, the court has to find that there was a conspiracy. And in finding that there was a conspiracy, the challenging the fact whether or not there was a conspiracy because one person was incompetent to enter into the agreement for the conspiracy. If you have a person who's incompetent to enter into the agreement and you don't have a conspiracy, then you don't have co-conspirator statements.
I understand that, but let's assume that you can, we decide that you can, and how that you can have a conspiracy with somebody that's incompetent.
Okay.
Although that may be a question of fact on competency. But what then, once those statements come in, let's say that person is incompetent.
Okay.
How do you challenge, or how did you challenge, the veracity of those statements?
Well, that brings up another point, another issue I raised, was Mr. Teagan was unable to challenge the veracity of those. He was unable to confront the co-conspirator. There was no finding that the co-conspirator was unavailable to testify. That I could find in the record. There was no making of offer by the state that she was unavailable. She was at the Human Services Center. So Mr. Teagan was unable to cross-examine this person.
Except she was still being charged.
She was still being charged.
And that had not, she hadn't pled or anything like that.
That is correct. He you know, a person could be called to testify and they could invoke their Fifth Amendment.
You invoked the Crawford
Yes.
Crawford case saying that because of the Supreme Court's decision in recent years that hearsay doesn't necessarily allow, hearsay rules don't necessarily allow things in.
Correct.
But, I look in the record and I see that the trial judge took that under advisement. Did she ever make a ruling on whether the Crawford case applied or didn't apply?
I don't recall seeing any specific ruling about Crawford. I remember seeing it taken under advisement. I remember it just as it went forward.
So is the issue preserved for our review, then, if she never made a decision?
I believe so, Your Honor, because Mr. Sperling did testify to or did object to a line of questioning with Ms. Beebe, objected, and the court indicated objection noted, overruled, and it's preserved.
And that's how all the hearsay came in?
Yes.
And the objection was based on Crawford, or was it a general objection?
It was a general objection, Your Honor. I don't believe the trial court allowed or Mr. Sperling to come in and say, Your Honor, I'm objecting on, A, B, C, D. Common practice among trial court is you make your objection.
No speaking objections.
Correct. This isn't Law and Order on TV.
Right.
Well, so, but you could certainly say a Crawford objection.
You could say a Crawford objection, yes, Your Honor. Okay. That's correct. But I think since this all had been pretrial argued, that by saying I object on the previous, that covers it.
So back to my question,
yes.
Were you able to challenge anything about it? I mean, was the fact that she was determined to be incompetent, was that ever before the jury?
I don't recall that being indicated to the jury. Like I said, I was not trial counsel. I went through the transcripts. I don't recall that being brought up.
So there was no alternative. I mean, there was, since she was not there and it all came in hearsay, you were not able to question. Or how were you able to question?
Basically, the only thing that we'd be able to question was the person relating the statement would be Tel Cook, Duana Beebe, and then Jamie Keefe, I believe was the other one, would be questioning their recollection of the statements or how they were said, something like that. That's the only way you can challenge those. And that's
slippery slope. If we determine that those statements came in improperly, what was your prejudice? Is there enough prejudice here to reverse it?
Yes. The prejudice is you have these different people saying that this alleged co-conspirator is saying that they did all this stuff or made these statements that further boasts the state's case. I mean, without those statements, they don't have that whole. Some of those witnesses are not able to testify as to what was being said, therefore what may be the intent or the thoughts of the declarant or Mr. Teagan.
But what about the fact that we have a witness who says that he saw that your client showed him Mr. Klug's tied up body in the back of his trunk? And what about that? And then what about the letters that your client apparently wrote while in jail?
Okay, that takes me to other arguments.
Assuming that those were allowable.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be overwhelming evidence of your client's guilt, regardless of whether the court erred in allowing these conspirator statements in?
I don't believe that's necessarily overwhelming evidence. As far as the statement that I saw this person's body in a trunk, that came from a co-defendant who ended up pleading out to a Class 1 misdemeanor, that being able to go from life in prison to 1 year in the county jail.
So did the jury get an instruction on co-defendant testimony that they'll view it with skepticism?
There was an instruction, I believe, on that. But that was one of three people testifying on this co-conspirator stuff. And that, you take out all three of them, and now you have just this one person saying, I saw this body, and all of a sudden you can say, well, but you didn't say you saw that body the three times before you talked to law enforcement. That becomes more credible to the jury than these other two people coming in saying this person's making these statements, along with this person. So where these two might be more credible than this person, they bolster his credibility.
How incriminating are your clients?
Pardon?
How incriminating are your clients' own letters?
The letters, you know, when you read those letters, it doesn't say I did this to him or I did that. It talks about some process, you know, some grinding, some things like that. But it doesn't say, you know, in fish food, I think. But it doesn't say, okay, I did this to Troy, I did this to Troy, I did this. It didn't say anything like that.
But it refers to the victim being used for fish food.
Yeah, I believe it says that. But those, I think, also was an error coming in by the trial court. And I raised that issue. Under the Masai case, in which the state can't use other people, individuals, to come in and find evidence for them that they can't. Some notable facts I want to bring up for the court in my remaining time. Do I have time, Judge?
I think you've got about a minute.
All right, thank you. He was told by DCI agents, if I was in your place, I'd be pounding the dirt trying to find stuff. DCI had been approached. This is one of the biggest cases in Western South Dakota in recent memories. And everybody in the Pennington County Jail was coming up to law enforcement saying, hey, I'll inform for you if you can give me a deal, all that sort of stuff. DCI's going, no, he's got an attorney. We can't do that. But with Tell Cook, they told him to do that before he had an attorney, and then they never called him off. They never said, Tell, you can't be doing anything now. He's got an attorney.
Let me just keep the timing on
yes.
this. You know, like, you better be pounding the pavement.
Yeah.
Was that a comment that was made at the time that both Cook and the defendant were in jail together?
I believe it was made during the interviewing process of Mr. Cook, and at some point, I think Mr. Teagan, they were looking for Mr. Teagan at that point.
Your time has expired, Mr. Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know, the present appeal stems from a kidnapping and apparent murder taking place in Rapid City on July 12, 2004. The record reveals that the victim in this case, Troy Klug, had gone to see the defendant's girlfriend, Cynthia Kendall, that afternoon intending to buy drugs. Unfortunately for the victim, this was a case of a drug deal gone bad. Neither the victim's family or his girlfriend ever saw from him again. Testimony was presented at a trial that the victim owed Kendall money for an earlier drug purchase. Now, how much money we're talking about? According to Tell Cook, a friend of the defendant's, the victim owed Kendall a mere $250. Cook testified that the defendant and Kendall showed up at his house in Belle Fourche early on the morning of July 14th, began pounding on the windows and wanted in. He described both Cook and Kendall as being really upset, real skittish. They started talking about a guy named Troy who lived in Rapid City and owed them money. They then referred to him as a snitch and a rat. The defendant specifically told Cook that the victim had gone to Kendall's that afternoon intending or wanting to purchase drugs. The defendant, however, was there and instead sent the victim downstairs to clean out Kendall's basement. The defendant then boasted to Cook how that when the victim was done cleaning, he hit on him, beat on him a little, bound him with duct tape, and threw him in the trunk of Kendall's car. The defendant then told Cook, hey, come outside and see this. Once outside, the defendant then opened the trunk of Kendall's vehicle, and Cook was surprised to see the victim lying inside with his feet and hands bound with duct tape. Cook testified that he knew the victim was still alive because he could hear the victim groan when the defendant punched him in the back. Cook asked the defendant and Kendall what they were going to do with the victim, and they responded they were going to go to North Dakota and dig a hole. Now, the defendant and Kendall left Cook's later that day, but they returned again on the morning of July 15th. Cook asked what they had done with the victim, and the defendant responded they had put the body in a metal toolbox in the back of a pickup truck. When asked by Cook if they had bothered to give him any water or anything to drink since it was so hot that afternoon, the defendant responded, no, it's too late for that. The defendant told Cook that he had gone out to the pickup several times that afternoon just to beat on the victim. According to the defendant, while beating on a victim, he could feel the bones in his face crush. According to the defendant, that's what did him in. Now, with that in mind, the first issue the state would like to address you today.
Now, all those statements you just quoted, though, are all co-conspirator statements, is that right?
Most of the statements were attributed directly to the defendant in his conversations with Cook.
All right. So were those, did they come in under the co-conspirator?
Co-conspirator statements, or specifically the other statute, statement against interest.
All right.
The defendant argues that the trial court erred in allowing the state to introduce any evidence, statements made by Cynthia Kendall, arguing that Kendall was found incompetent to stand trial and, according to the defendant, hence mentally insane. The defendant contends that he cannot enter into a conspiracy agreement with someone who is legally insane. The defendant's argument, however, ignores the prior holdings of this court that incompetency to stand trial and the incapacity to commit a crime due to legal insanity are two separate and distinct issues. The state would submit the fact that Kendall was at one time found incompetent to stand trial does not mean that she's legally insane at the time of the kidnapping.
But counsel's not arguing that. He's arguing that we should use contract principles because there's a contract between conspirators. Are you aware of any cases where the courts look at conspiracy and use contract principles to decide whether a conspiracy existed or not?
None whatsoever. The only case I'm aware of is the case cited to in a defendant's brief, State versus Regal, and it's readily distinguishable from the facts in the present case because there the co-conspirator was subsequently determined to be legally insane and therefore hence acquitted of the criminal charges. Here in the findings of facts, the trial court judge Kern specifically found a finding of incompetency to stand trial is not the legal or factual equivalent of lacking the mental capacity to enter into a conspiracy. The defendant's argument not only fails to distinguish between the two, but it also ignores the fact that Kendall was subsequently found to be competent to stand trial. In findings of fact, it concludes as a law dated August 30, 2006, the trial court found that her competency had been restored to the extent that she was now able to assist with the defense.
Well, if they're both incompetent, can you have a conspiracy then?
There's no argument that the defendant is incompetent at the time of the question.
I understand that, but I'm trying to hone in on the legal status of the one that is incompetent. You're saying it doesn't make any difference. If it doesn't make any difference, what if they're both incompetent?
The state would simply say that there's no evidence in the record which she would be able to rate back the finding of incompetence to the time in question, the date of the kidnapping. In fact, if you look at the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, you need to know what was found or stated therein. Those findings indicate that Kendall had engaged in active deception. Based on her behavior, it was said that she was malingering as to the extent of her mental illness. According to the psychiatrist who performed the evaluation, she was said to be embellishing her symptoms and she was able to function at the very highest level when it was in her best interest to do so.
Was this the psychiatrist whose testimony was discounted by Judge Tice, or is this the one that Judge Tice accepted?
I assume Judge Tice accepted the psychiatrist's testimony, determined that she was later competent to proceed to trial. She subsequently entered a guilty plea, not a GMMI plea. Finally, the defense argument ignores testimony record that Kendall was the ringleader. When asked if Kendall was the boss, Cook specifically testified it sure appeared that way to me. The defendant himself told law enforcement that he had simply gone along for the ride. The circuit court therefore found that there was nothing in the findings of fact entered by Judge Tice that would lead this court to believe that Ms. Kendall was not sufficiently rational based on her conduct established by the substantial evidence in the record to enter into an agreement with Tori Teagan to kidnap Troy Clue. In the trial court's view, and I quote again, there was substantial evidence of Kendall's knowledge and active coherent participation in the ongoing conspiracy with Teagan to kidnap the victim. Now, even if you assume for sake of argument that the trial court erred in admitting Kendall's statements into evidence, the defendant still has not shown that it amounted to prejudicial error. In order to establish prejudice, the defendant must be able to show that absent Kendall's statements, there is a reasonable probability the results of the trial would have changed, i.e. he would have been acquitted. Here, the state would submit that there's ample evidence in the record to support the defendant's conviction, even without Kendall's testimony. In that regard, there's testimony record from Tal Cook that the defendant took him out to the vehicle, opened a trunk, and showed him Troy Klug's, the victim's body, stuffed inside. When Cook later asked about the victim, the defendant remarked something to the effect, it's too late for him. The defendant once again told Cook how, while beating on a victim, he had managed to break or crush the bones in his face. More importantly, there's also the matter of the letters that the defendant wrote to Talbot Cook while they were housed in the Minnehaha County Jail. In those letters, the defendant maintains, trust me, they ain't gonna find nobody. Although the defendant claimed he had some difficulty in deciding what to do with the body initially, he stated in those letters that he had finally come up with a perfect plan and had executed it with what he referred to as grinding precision. He told Cook that if you're going to make fish food, you might as well make it in bite-sized pieces. According to the defendant, it was the nastiest thing I've done, by far the nastiest. Finally, the record shows that when conducting a search of Kendall's vehicle, law enforcement recovered a hair that was pressed into the sealant-like substance around the taillight in the rear of the trunk. That hair was later sent to forensic experts for analysis. It was determined to belong to the victim, Troy Klug.
How did they determine that? DNA analysis?
DNA analysis. Testimonies presented that the DNA profile was so rare that, according to experts, we would not expect to find it in unrelated individuals in the whole world population. Based on the testimony, including the scientific evidence, the state would submit the defendant would have been convicted irregardless of Kendall's statements. The other issue the state would like to briefly touch on here today is in reference to the letters written by the defendant while in jail. The defendant argues that his Sixth Amendment right to counsel was violated when the state was allowed to introduce those two letters into evidence. The defendant maintains that Cook was somehow acting as an agent for the state, that the letters therefore should have been suppressed. As indicated, however, in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, the burden was on the defendant to show that Cook was acting on behalf of the state. Typically, an informant will be deemed an agent of the state if he's acting pursuant to instructions or directions from the police. The police, must have specifically enlisted his assistance or aid. Here, the trial court specifically found at no time in this case did Agent Gromer or any other law enforcement officer ask Talbot Cook to elicit information from the defendant. The trial court specifically found that Cook made the personal decision as to what letters from the defendant to keep and what letters to throw away. That, in the court's opinion, served to further corroborate the fact that Tal Cook was acting of his own volition. Based on the evidence and the testimony that was presented at the suppression hearing, the trial court found, and I quote, Cook was not acting on behalf of law enforcement while obtaining the incriminating letters from the defendant. In arguing otherwise, the defendant makes reference to some statement made by Agent Gromer, where he told Cook he better pound pavement than do every GD thing he could. A review of the record, however, reveals that statement was made when Cook was first interviewed by law enforcement back on July 20th of 2004. At the time, law enforcement were still in the process of trying to ascertain the whereabouts of defendant and Kendall. They hadn't been located, let alone arrested. More importantly, the defendant concedes in his brief that Tal Cook testified that he didn't even remember Agent Gromer ever having made any such statement. In fact, when he was called to testify regarding the July 20th interview, Cook testified that Agent Gromer never asked him to obtain any information from the defendant. According to Cook, Agent Gromer never asked him to serve as an informant, and he didn't consider himself as such. His testimony was supported and substantiated by that of his own attorney, Randall Connolly. Connolly testified that Cook never said anything to him about his having been approached by law enforcement asked to obtain information from the defendant. Connolly, therefore, was just as surprised as anyone else when Cook produced the two letters the defendant had written. When provided with those letters, it was Connolly who initiated contact with the police on September 30th and said he had information they thought might help move the investigation along. A review of the record reveals, up until that time, Agent Gromer had no knowledge whatsoever of the letters in question. The state would submit that the defendant's argument ignores Tal Cook's testimony that he had reached a turning point in his life after we saw the victim's mother crying at the arraignment hearing on August 16, 2004. It was then that Cook understood the impact that this had had on the victim's family. He thereafter approached his attorney, Connolly, in regard to cooperating with the state. Connolly, however, instructed Cook not to make any waves and to keep his contacts with the defendant to a minimum. The decision, therefore, to write to the defendant while in jail was tell Cook's and Cook's alone. Testimony was elicited from Cook that he made that decision all on his own. When questioned, so what you're telling us in the court is that law enforcement had nothing to do with what you did, Tal Cook responded, that's what I'm telling you. The record, therefore, clearly shows that Cook was acting without any assistance or directions from law enforcement. Now, the defendant argues that law enforcement must have somehow known what Cook was doing and basically turned him loose in hopes that he might gather incriminating evidence from the defendant.
Well, their jail cells at one point were right next to each other. Is that right?
Correct.
Was there any
testimony? Defendant made some sort of argument that supported an inference that law enforcement intentionally housed them beside each other. Sean Wood, a lieutenant for the Pennington County Jail, testified that if any such instructions had been given, they would have been documented, they would have been reflected in, I believe you referred to the shift briefing notes, or somewhere else. Wood undertook to research and review jail documents and was not able to find anything which would suggest that there had been instructions given as to where to house.
Is there some policy in the jail or any in this jail in particular where they put co-defendants in adjoining cells, or is there a policy against that?
That I don't know. There was no testimony in the record to reflect that. Here, specifically, the trial court found that at no time during the incarceration of Tal Cook and Tory Teagan were housing instructions, indoor classifications, and suggestions given by law enforcement to Pennington County Jail.
Can you discuss how Kendall's testimony came in and is not in violation of Crawford?
It should be noted at the outset that although the defendant had raised a Crawford issue, the trial court, Judge Kern, had indicated that she considered the issue to be premature because there was no indication at that time prior to trial whether Kendall would be made available for purposes of testifying. The parties were, I believe, were specifically instructed to re-raise that issue as they neared close to the trial date.
Was there any then, was there ever a determination by the trial court that the that Ms. Kendall was unavailable?
I don't believe so because
so how
in the subsequent brief submitted by the defendant, he didn't raise or re-raise the Crawford issue.
But
even assuming that she was unavailable, case law makes it rather clear that not all hearsay implicates the Confrontation Clause under Crawford.
Okay, but tell me why this doesn't. Why this fits into the category that where it doesn't apply.
Typically, the Confrontation Clause is aimed at hearsay statements which are said to be testimonial in nature, those that are said to bear witness. In Crawford, the court said that those statements typically consist of ex parte in-court testimony and or their functional equivalent, such as depositions, affidavits, custodial interrogations, and or confessions. The only other formulation testimony evidence identified and offered are statements made under circumstances which would lead an objective person to reasonably believe that those statements would later be used at trial. The key, therefore, is whether the person making the statement was acting to a substantial degree with an eye toward producing evidence for use at trial. Here, it simply cannot be said that Kendall's statements were made with an eye toward trial. Defendant has not pointed to any reasonable expectation on Kendall's part that her statements would later be used against him. In fact, it seems rather clear that Kendall probably expected that Beebe, Cook, and Jamie Keefe wouldn't repeat anything she said, let alone to law enforcement.
How does the defendant then challenge the veracity of those statements if they can't? Let's say she was incompetent. How do you get that information in front of the jury to determine whether or not they are accurate?
I believe what you have to do on cross-examination then would be to try to dwell into the facts and circumstances under which she made the statements in regard to, in this particular case, whoever happened to be testifying, whether it be Tal Cook or Duane Beebe.
Was it ever in front of the jury that she was found incompetent at some later time?
I don't believe, I didn't prosecute the case, and I don't believe in the cold record there was any reference to her absence due to unavailability due to mental competency. And again, the state would submit, even absent Kendall's statements, there's ample evidence in the record to support conviction. Now, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would close by simply asking that the defendant's convictions be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Deegan. Mr. Lewis, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here's where it gets to be interesting. The state wants to argue that you can be incompetent and still have a conspiracy, and therefore you can make these statements that are supposedly alleged or that were made in the furtherance of this conspiracy to cover up this conspiracy, but you cannot expect that those be used against you later on to the testimonial portion of Crawford. If a person has got this big conspiracy going on, you'd reasonably expect that they would believe that anything they say would be used against them later. And when they're saying it to the girlfriend, another co-defendant, that's the type of statements that come in you see at trials later on.
Well, don't most conspirators think they're not going to be caught?
Well, I would say that most people charged with a criminal case don't believe that they are where they are. So, but the thing about it is, if you have this big conspiracy, you're going to, you know, you got to be careful what you're saying, supposedly, because it can come back to you. So the state wants to say, you can have this, but you can't have this with regards to confrontation because of testimonial. I believe there was a question about Ms. Kendall being returned or found to be returned to competency. Judge Kern heard that second hearing. Judge Tice did not. I don't know if that clears up anything or not, but it was Judge Tice initially heard it, and then when it came back, Judge Kern heard it.
And do we know why or how she was restored? She went to Human Services Center. Presumably she received some medication. Is that what helped her to
I believe. I don't have access. I didn't have access to those findings, so I'm not going to speculate or guess because I'll probably get a penalty for that. So,
I won't penalize you if you answer my question.
Well,
that's all right. If you don't know the answer, that's a fair answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the matter with Tal Cook, here's a guy who says I'm playing cop. Part of his testimony. He's been told by the police that he should probably do something to better himself, and he goes out playing cop. He may decide conveniently what letters not to throw away and what to keep, but, you know, there is a guy going from life in prison to 1 year in the county jail. And this guy is doing what he can to find out information, and whether or not the police know he's doing or not, they initially started him down that road. They opened the gates. They, you know, trying to put the cow back in the gates there.
Well, I agree with you. There's some suspicious circumstances. You know, they're right by each other, the same, you know, adjoining cells, and there's these comments. But how do we overcome what the trial judge determined on a credibility basis? The trial judge believed the police and believed Mr. Cook and didn't adopt your position. How can we say, looking at a cold record, that this is wrong?
Well, I think that it is, in reviewing the facts, if you believe that the judge made a clearly erroneous ruling, I believe you can overrule her. And I believe she did in this case. I mean, being next to each other in the jail, co-defendants, that I never came across that when I was in the public defender's office. They were always somewhere else. So, And, you know, Mr. Conley, defense attorney for Mr. Cook, Mr. Geegan brought up his testimony. You know, I hate to burst anyone's bubble, but defendants don't always tell their attorneys everything. We find out things at the most inopportune times. So the fact that he may not have told his attorney things is really irrelevant to what he was doing. There's, Mr. Keegan brought up this hair that was found as overwhelming evidence. Well, that kind of goes part to the delays in testing things here. Mr. Keegan was requesting his trial within the time frames. And the state kept saying, no, we got this stuff out for testing. And this items the with this hair was not sent to testing until like February of 2005. And, you know, he's requesting all this evidence and all this stuff so we can go to trial early as November. There was delay in getting him to trial by the state in sending stuff out for testing. And it goes to that Sixth Amendment right to speedy trial versus the 180 days.
I understand, though, that the trial didn't, the delay did not exceed a year.
It did not exceed a year.
And we presume that if it does exceed a year, then there's then we'll delve into it. But here, there isn't even a presumption of an undue delay, is there?
No. It's real close on that year point. I mean, he may have appeared on the indictment on the 16th of August, but he was in custody from the 20th of July. And this went to trial on the 20th of July. Now, the 180-day rule goes from when you first make your appearance before a judge, whereas I believe the constitutional argument is when you're incarcerated, because sometimes it takes time to make before a judge and stuff. So he was incarcerated in July of 2004.
So he was. So then the presumption of undue delay is then does kick in because it was more than a year? Or
I believe so, yes. I mean, he didn't make the appearance until August 16th, but he was in custody long before that in July.
But what date do we use in order to...
Well, for the constitutional argument, it would be the July when he was taken into custody.
So he was. So then the presumption does kick in?
Yes, it would kick in at that point. The prejudice in this case on the co-conspirator hearsay and is all that kind of forms the basis. You've got one guy who's a co-defendant and you can attack his credibility, going from mandatory life to a year in jail. But now all of a sudden you have two other people who are coming up saying things that all of a sudden it's like, well, this guy may be a dirtbag, but he's saying kind of the same things as these two people. And so therefore he must be more credible. Well, now you've got these other two people bolstering this person's credibility, so when he starts talking about things, he's going to be more credible than before, when it's just some guy who cut a deal for a year in the county jail instead of life in South Dakota Penn. So, that's the prejudice. You have these other people coming in and being able to say that Cynthia Kendall's making these statements, and then Cal Cook saying she's making these statements, and then Tory Teagan's making
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. Tory Teagan's making these statements. Therefore, he becomes more. They're all three become their credibility goes up because it's three different people saying similar things about what's going on. So that's the prejudice that increases their value to the jury. And I don't believe any instruction can really limit a person's credibility in certain. You can tell the jury, oh, this person can be deemed to be. You have to determine the credibility because of this. But sometimes juries may not be hearing that or focusing on other things. I'd like to thank the court for setting oral arguments on this matter and setting the oral arguments at the university. The last time I came before you, I was at South Dakota State. This time I'm up at Black Hills State. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.